Tessa Darbase, Tuesday the 11th of March, Rabbi Danny Kirsch, Daniel and the Seeds of Purim.
It's always an honor to start the morning with Start the Torah, and it's a tremendous way on the journey. It's a tremendous way to prepare for Purim. We now only have 3 or 4 shopping days left till Purim, and the opportunity to choose your favorite shlachmanas for your favorite rabbi. So there's an interesting halacha which is brought down in the Ramah, minhag, halacha. The Ramah brings down, on Purim, there are those who eat foods of vegetables, of legumes, of seeds, bapurim. There's a mitzvah. I always wonder where the Chomentoshen come from, not which store they come from, but the tradition of Chomentoshen. And I've done a little bit of research. It seems that the idea of having some seeds, some poppy seeds, within these cakes and biscuits probably finds its beginning to this tradition. There's a tradition to have legumes, beans, seeds on Purim. The Ramah says, Zeichel lezoronim sha'ochel doniel v'charerov b'vovel. As a reminder, as a memory, to the fact that Doniel ate particular foods, we'll see more about that in a moment, together with his close friends in Bova. That's what the Ramah writes, that there's a tradition to have particular foods on Purim. The Mishnah Berurim brings down whether this is on the first night or during the day, but so the tradition is. The Mishnah Berurim also adds, Doniel v'chavera, v'gam Esther ochel zoronim, and also Esther. Queen Esther ate particular foods, and it brings the Gemara in Megillah. The Gemara in Megillah tells us that Esther, though that she was cared for and given all the opulence and opportunity to perfect herself and beautify herself to ready stand before the king, as we know how she behaved and how she held back, but also Chazal tell us that she refused to eat the food which was given to her as well. How was she able, therefore, to retain her physical status? She had vegetarian. She was a vegan. Sorry, I'm a vegetarian. That's all I'm going to eat. And she ate particular foods, legumes, beans, and other such things. And perhaps that's the tradition that since they ate seeds, we also have some poppy seed food on Purim as well. It's very interesting because if one looks throughout Tanakh, one comes across a reoccurring theme. And we're going to call this the law of unintended consequences. There's the law of intended consequences, there's the law of unintended consequences. Reb Chaim Friedlander points out the moshel by Yosef HaTzadik. By Yosef HaTzadik, the brothers heard the dream. And the brothers said, are we going to bow down to him? No way! So what are our options? We kill him. That's one option. Alternative option is we'll sell him as a slave down to Mitzrayim. Because once a slave is part of the caste system of Egypt, once a person becomes a slave, there's no way he can rid himself and catapult himself out of that into leadership. So that's the way, says Reb Chaim Friedlander, we can ensure that his dream won't possibly come true. He'll be a slave in Egypt. Of course, the irony was he gets sold to Potiphar, and then you have the story of the butler, and then you're in prison, and then eventually the butler is able to tell Paro. And because the brothers sold him as a slave to Egypt, he's eventually catapulted into a position of great leadership, and Paro chooses him to be second to him only. But the intention was for sure not that. Their intention was, as a slave, there's no way. Another example which is given by Rav Simcha Zissel Ziv is Moshe Rabbeinu. Paro had the intention that his astrologers would tell him that the Moshiach of Klal Yisrael, the Moshiach of the Jewish people, will be born, but his downfall will be, as you know, through water. So Paro was advised to take all the Jewish babies and throw them into the water. Moshe Rabbeinu's downfall was later going to be through water. As we know, he hit the rock instead of speaking to it. But Paro's daughter was the one who saved Moshe from the water that was supposed to be the destruction of the future Moshiach of Klal Yisrael. Moshe Rabbeinu was placed in the first ever Moses basket, and he was put in the water there, and it was Paro's own daughter who saved him. And Rav Simcha Zissel points out what a tremendous irony that Moshe Rabbeinu was brought up in the world that wanted to destroy him, where he was taught all the protocol and statecraft of how to be in that world, which will be relevant to his leadership position in years to come. The law of unintended consequences, that for sure was not on the mind of Paro when he made his edict. Another example which is brought, Haman of Russia. Haman sees that Ahasuerus is somewhat perplexed by the fact that Vashti doesn't listen to his command. And he describes to him that, you know, the female world is going to be in a terrible situation as a result of it. You're undermining. You have to do something about it. So Haman's advice was, as we know, to kill Vashti. Kill Vashti. And as a result of killing Vashti, Ahasuerus is left without... He wants a wife. And therefore, as a result of what Haman suggested, ironically, Esther gets chosen to be the wife. And then when Haman makes the edicts against Klal Yisrael, Esther's in the unique position because of the fact that he said, I want to kill Vashti, you need to kill Vashti. As a result of that, Esther later on is going to be in a unique position to save Klal Yisrael. And many, many examples such as this. And another example which I want to share with you as a honor for Purim is the story of Donia. So an extraordinary story, and unfortunately doesn't get the publicity that all of us with that name feel it should have. But also all of those who appreciate and understand the nisim and niflois of the story of Donia. This is also a very unintended consequences. Because Nebuchadnezzar laying siege to Yerushalayim, Nebuchadnezzar sends off his Vayoma Melech La'ashpanaz. He sends off to one of his trusted servants, Lahavi mi b'nei Yisrael. What I want you to do is, I want you to go to b'nei Yisrael and find me mizera hamlucha. Find me people who come from the great seed of Malchus, from Shevet Yehuda. Yelodim, children, asheim behem komum. Who don't, and Ibn Ezra points out an extraordinary thing. Who were these Yelodim that we're talking about? They were, according to the Ibn Ezra, he works out, Daniel was 15 at the time. 15 years old. And we're going to see what an extraordinary individual Daniel becomes and the influence he's able to have on the world. And what are some of the qualifications that we're looking for? So they have to be good looking. Umaskilim b'chol chochma. They have to be wise and understanding and all wisdom. They want a Jewish cup. He wants Jewish brains. V'yodeh das. And they have the ability, the way the Mephoshim explained it wasn't yodeh das, is they have the ability to hear somebody speaking and realize and recognizing what they're saying before they themselves have finished their own sentence. In other words, they're not just the ability to hear and understand, but I can semi-predict what it is that you're going to say by virtue of what Mevin Mada. They're people who have the great understanding. The way the Ebenezer explains the Mevin Mada is that they can have the ability to articulate what it is that they know. Not only that they're wise, not only that they're clever, not only that they have all the knowledge, not only that they can hear something you're saying, but when they need to speak, they can articulate. And the Ibn Ezra says famously, there are many wise people who despair of bringing to their tongue what is in their mind. It's there, it sits there brilliantly. The problem is that they can't communicate it. And what Nebuchadnezzar is looking for is, if I'm taking people into my civil service, I want them to be able to understand something and be able to explain it to me as well. How many geniuses have we come across who have the ability to understand it but not necessarily communicate? Nebuchadnezzar gives in his list of qualifications the fact that they have the ability to understand and explain it to me as well. And they have to be strong physically and able to be able to stand up amongst and in the courtyard of the king. Nebuchadnezzar goes searching and sends his trusted servants to search into Eretz Yisrael to get the wisest, the brightest, the most intelligent that are possible to be found. Vayehi mehem mibnei Yehuda. And he finds them, Baruch Hashem, from the tribe of Yehuda. And it's quite extraordinary that this was probably, if you see this in terms of the historical backdrop, you realize that Klal Yisrael have been in Eretz Yisrael since the time of Yeshua. Shlomo HaMelech builds the Beis HaMikdash. This is the beginning of the first Golus in Klal Yisrael's history. And this is the beginning of an incredible journey where Klal Yisrael will somehow find its greatest leaders in incredible positions in the non-Jewish world. The non-Jewish world recognizes the brilliances of the Jews and they want Yiddish brains. And I think it continues all the way to this very day. I have a friend of mine who is a lawyer, and he's approached by leading Arab clients, including some fascinating names, who want Yiddish brains. I was told that Safra's bank, the famous bank that he had in, he used to have a lot of Arab clients who wanted to trust their money with Yiddish brains. Interesting. A friend, somebody I know recently became a lord in the House of Lords. And I think there's between 700 and 800 lords in the House of Lords. So I said, how many Jews are there in the House of Lords? There's 89 lords. 89 lords. Imagine that. That's like 13% of all the lords in this country. That sounds a bit strange, but are Jewish. It's extraordinary. And we're less than 0.5%. So I said to him, tell me a little bit about what are these lords? Tell me a little bit out. Tell me who, what, where, what are the backgrounds? So he said, well, there's some which are backbenchers, and there's some which are front benchers, and there's some that don't know how to bench at all. So we had this, they're looking for Yiddish brains, and Doniel is chosen because of this extraordinary aptitude and ability that he had. Vayihi bahem ibnei Yehuda, Doniel, Hanani, Mishael, Azar. And he chooses amongst them the famous four in those names. But then the story of Daniel goes on to say that he changes their names and he wants them to assimilate. So he gives them Avodah Zarah, different names. He gives them different names. And I saw one of the four to point out. It's very interesting. Because if you look at the names of the four, Doni Kael, Hanan Ko, Mishael Kael. They all have the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Those four people have HaKadosh Baruch Hu name, either Aleph Lameth at the end or Yud Kei at the end. Each one of them have the name of Hashem. So what Nebuchadnezzar was, I want your genius, I want your wisdom, I want the Jewish brains, but I don't want you to remain Jewish. And therefore we'll change your names in order for you to assimilate. And he puts people in charge of them to ensure that they are looked after. And the process is that they go through a 3-year training process, a fast-track civil service, where they'll understand and appreciate all that goes on in Bovel. And as part of the job, part of the deal, they're given yayin, wine to drink, and they're given food to eat. In order that they should be well, and they should be healthy, in order to... But Doniel has a bit of an issue here. Doniel says, it's not possible. How is it possible for me to be eating this food? Now, this is a broad subject for another time, but there is an interesting discussion about exactly what it was that he was concerned about. Because he was worried of the spiritual tumor that maybe some of the food which has been given to him was from Avodah Zarah and cooked in Kalim of Avodah Zarah, etc., etc. And that's clearly, if you look in the Mephoshim, that's clearly some of the aspects that he's concerned about. No question about it. However, he says, but how am I going to eat? What am I going to do? So he says, he went to the person who's in charge of them, and he says to them, "V'yitnu lona min hazaroyim v'nach mai v'nishta." What we want is, we want seeds, we want pulses, we want uncooked food. It says, hazaroyim, and from that, and before she learn out, not cooked. Specifically, I want it uncooked. And that's what we're going to eat, and that's what we're going to drink, and we're going to have water to drink, and that's how we're going to be able to survive. And the person in charge of them said, but that's impossible. Why is it impossible? Because my job is to prepare you for Nebuchadnezzar. And we've been given this financial opportunity from the government. I've given you housing, I've given you education, and I've got a food budget as well. I've got to make sure that you're well looked after and you're well fed so that you'll be able to stand in front of the king. There's no way you'll survive on this vegetarian seed diet, and therefore I'm afraid it can't be done. So Daniel says, give me a test. Let's try it. Let's give me 10 days, and we'll see how we look. We'll see how we appear after the end of the 10 days, and we'll see whether your fears are realized or not. So the Psukim go on to tell us that he listened very carefully, and it was quite extraordinary, because what does it say? After 10 days, Nira Mareim Tov, they taka look good, Vir Vosa, and they Kenainara, they were well looked after. In fact, they look better than all the Yolodim. They look better than the people who are eating the regular food. Baruch Hashem, they had a fantastic diet, and somehow they look better. It's interesting because the Mephoshim speak about the fact here The Alshech HaKadosh says there's two parts here. Number one is that they take a look good. And number one was that they had full flesh. Number two, they had full flesh. The Alshech points out there's two aspects to being fed. Number one is the food you eat. And number two is the Simchas HaChaim that you have in your life and the appearance that you give. And the many, many people who eat a lot of food, they don't have Simchas HaChaim. You're not a happy person. You're not confident of who you are and where you're going with life. Then you don't necessarily look well. Says the Alshech HaKadosh that the Sefer Daniel points out two things. Number one, they look good. And Kenai Nara, they're well fed as well. And he explains, because once you have in your mind the resolve, I'm doing this as an Eved Hashem. Once you realize that I'm eating a kosher food because this is what a Kodesh Baruch Hu wants me to do. And even though it's very difficult and everybody's against me and the norm will be completely different, but I'm an Eved Hashem. I'm an Eved Hashem. Says Alshech HaKadosh, not only are you well fed, Baruch Hashem, but you look good as well. And we can talk another time about the psychology of what it is to look good. And how it's interesting, you have all these Yiddish mamas who are pushing their children, eat, 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 but they have to give them the inner confidence to be good Yidden at the same time. Somebody once said, this is coming up to Purim, so a little, somebody once said to me, what's the difference between an Italian mother and a Jewish mother? So the Italian mother says, eat up or I kill you. And the Jewish mother says, eat up or you kill me. Because we all want our children to look good, we all long for it, but we have to give them the Simchas HaChaim in order to feel good. And Chazal tell there was nobody who looked as good as this Daniel. So after the 3 years, Daniel and his people, Mamish, they look extraordinarily well. And at the end of the years, the Pesukim tell us that they then brought the people in front of Nebuchadnezzar. And then the king forheard them. And the way the Pesukim tell us is that he couldn't find anybody who was as bright, as intelligent, and as good as Daniel and the others. In every matter of the art of reasoning that the king asked of them, he found them 10 times better than all the necromancers and astrologers that were in the entire kingdom. And then it says that Daniel was there until the first King Cyrus. And it's interesting because previously the Pesuk in describing how bright they became, immediately after talking about the fact that they held back in the food, the Pesuk says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave them learning and skill in every script and wisdom, and Daniel understood every kind of vision and dreams, which is going to stand him very well, as we're going to see in the story of Daniel and the various kings that he's going to serve. Mefarshim point out, why was it Dafka Daniel who understood every kind of vision and dreams? After all four of them didn't eat, but nevertheless, his name is mentioned specifically here. The Mefarshim explained because he was the one who led the process and said, we're not going to eat this food. He was the one who encouraged those around him. And in the schus of him leading, he was able to gain an extra measure of wisdom as well. So Daniel begins a journey in the world of Nebuchadnezzar of giving advice and direction, not only to Nebuchadnezzar, which he does in interpreting things, but to subsequent kings as well. In fact, according to the Mephoshim, he was about, as I say, 15 when he was taken into the king's service. He was a senior advisor for over 50 years. And not only was he a senior advisor, as we said, to Nebuchadnezzar, but you throw through the story of Daniel, he managed to continue in his position through king after king, through leader after leader. The famous story with Belshazzar and the meal, the writing on the wall, where he was the one, Belshazzar was a little concerned about this vision that he had, and Daniel was the one to interpret it and tell him that tomorrow isn't going to be like today, and that night Belshazzar passed away. And he prophesied that the power of the world of Babel will be passed on to Paras HaMadai. And in fact, this is exactly what happened. It was passed on to Paras HaMadai, and the extraordinary thing is that in Perek Vav it says that when Dariovish, who were already from Madai, he took over from Bovo, immediately Daniel was placed in a senior position. He created a legal system where he had 120 of the top judges and advisors who were advising him. Then he had a system of the very top three going to advise him. And within that, Daniel was placed in this extraordinary situation. And Daniel's fame continues all the way into the Purim story. As we know, the Gemara Megillas tell us that because Daniel was in Paros HaMada as an advisor, that continued all the way into the time of Achashverosh as well. And Daniel was the go-between between Mordechai and Esther and giving the messages. He was caught by Haman, and he was killed by Haman, according to Chazal. But Daniel's influence continued all the way through the story of Purim. And in fact, many point out that the fact that Klal Yisrael were able to live in Bavel and eventually even build the great Babylonian communities was in no short measure due to the fact that Nebuchadnezzar chose Daniel with the hope that he would assimilate him and acculturate him into his society, but ironically caused himself his own downfall. So we have this extraordinary story of Daniel, the Jew in exile, senior advisor to the king, but the person who managed to retain his commitment to Yiddishkeit in all situations and in all circumstances. What's amazing is to this very day on Purim, we eat particular foods to remind ourselves of the ability that Daniel had to hold back. I'm not going to participate. And the ability that Daniel had, even in that world, to have that self-control. The Mephoshim point out another interesting part of Daniel's famous career, of course, is the story of the lions. When Daniel is thrown into the lion's den as animal fodder. And there's much discussion about the message and the symbolism over there, just to put things into context, and it's so extraordinary one understands what happens ad hayom hazeh, that because Daniel was in such an important position, given that position by Dayovish. By the way, you have to look at the history books, how many Dayovishes they were, when they were, etc., etc., because there's another one later, the Esther's, etc., etc. But it's extraordinary to note that Dayovish gave him this important position, and the non-Jewish people around were incredibly jealous. And they created a situation. They couldn't fault him in his ethics. They couldn't fault him in his integrity and his morality. So that what they tried to do is create a situation where he'd have to be faced in terms of his own Yiddishkeit. Would he be strong enough for his Yiddishkeit? And they passed an edict there, which the king himself passed, which was the only person you're allowed to show, being God, you're allowed to show allegiance to is the king himself, or Dayovish is God, but to no other God or no other being except for that. And the story of Daniel tells us how every single day, three times a day, Daniel would open his window and face Yerushalayim. Again, first time Klal Yisrael in Golus, the individual, he would face Yerushalayim. And he would daven unaffected by the edict. He was found out, taken in front of the king. And the king, unfortunately, had to, even though he was loved Daniel, nevertheless, he had to follow his edict. And the rule was, he threw him into the lion's den. The king put a seal on the lion's den, bothered by it all night, comes early in the next morning, sees his seal untouched, calls out to Daniel, and miraculously, Daniel survives, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu sent Malochim to stop the lions from eating him. And you have this extraordinary inner strength of Daniel, fighting for what is right, davening to HaKadosh Baruch Hu regardless. And then when you see the Pesukim afterwards, and I highly recommend you to read this, how the king, how Dayovish, only speaks about Daniel afterwards, and tells the world to show homage and pray to the God of Daniel. But the symbolism here is a very interesting one. And that is, Daniel is placed into the lion's den, and the lions don't touch him. There's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, and the Mishnah tells us that by Yehuda ben Tamar, the Mishnah tells us that you have to be gibor ka'ari. You have to be strong like a lion. There, each one of the midas that described to us, what does it mean to be gibor ka'ari? And the Tiferes Yisrael says a very interesting thing is, and that is, a lion's strength is his ability to defend himself. Defend himself and defend his environment around him. Because there are lots of predators who are out, and the lion's keenly looking around to make sure nobody touches. I'm the king of the jungle, I'm the king over here. And the Tiferes Yisrael explains that the king of the jungle that we have to learn in terms of our own midas to be gibor ka'ari is to realize that there's a lot of things out there which want to get us. There are lots of things, and we have to be the king of the jungle. In fact, we have to be the king of our own jungle. Because the Mishnah tells us earlier, Ezo gibor ha-kovish es Yisrael. You really want to have muscles, you really want to be strong. That's a Daniel has the ability to have self-control. The ability to control oneself. And of course, Daniel comes from Shevet Yehuda. And the symbolism of Shevet Yehuda is the symbol of an Ari, the symbol of a lion. Because a true leader of Klal Yisrael is not got to be fierce as a lion only, and a strong leader, but he has to be controlling of like a lion, but he has to control himself. If you can control yourself, you control others. Or some of the Mephoshim put it is, if you can control the lion within you, it's much easier to control the lions outside of you. And Daniel had the ability, through his self-sacrifices and his self-control, to have an impact on the whole of Jewish history forever. And Esther continues. She refuses to assimilate. She refuses to become part of the culture. And to this day, we eat foods to remind ourselves of the fact that they didn't eat. And on the day of Purim, when the world indulges and we indulge physically, and of course we remind ourselves the tremendous bracha and opportunity that we have is because we have self-control. And because our leaders learn to say, no, I don't do this. I remember years ago, my father was honored by the Lord Mayor of London. He was one of the head of one of the guilds of London. It's a long story. So we had a meal at the Mansion House. And beautifully laid out, wonderful. And of course, Hermolis were there to look after us. And as you walk in to take your seats, they come up to you and say, by the way, this is where you're sitting. And it's all under Hashkocha, don't worry. Because they try to match everything for everything at these places. The only thing that Hermolis don't manage to match is the size of the portions. And we had a lot of sort of the non-Jewish or non-religious people looking on and said, like, my high, you know, Zotoria, Zosora. I mean, look at this, it's incredible. There's no reason why we shouldn't have the strength of confidence to absolutely stand up for everything that we believe in. And those who stand up, many years ago I was traveling in a cab in Eretz Yisrael, and here a cab driver was listening to an Amnon Yitzchok talk. And Amnon Yitzchok was telling a story about one of the seminars that he'd run. And in the seminar, he had lots of people. There was one gentleman who was very, very overweight. And he didn't seem particularly interested in anything that was going on in the classes. And at the end of the seminar, Amnon Yitzchok said to them, you know, does anybody feel they've learned anything from the seminar? And this man said, yes, I've decided from now on I'm going to have a kosher home. So Amnon Yitzchok said, well, he was falling asleep during the drushes. Like, he showed complete disinterest. So he said, tell me, why is it you decided to have kosher? So he says, because wherever I go, I take food with me. I take lots of sweets with me as well to indulge. And as soon as I feel the urge, I just put them in my mouth. But I'm a good person. I share them with others as well. And there's a couple of these little children come up to me, so I give them a sweet. There's a six-year-old who picks up the sweet. And instead of just throwing it to the mouth, he looks at the packaging. Never seen that before. And then I watch him as he goes over to what I presume is his mother and shows him the sweet, her the sweet. And she looks this way and look that way. She shakes her head and she takes the sweet and gives it to her son. And her son throws it in the rubbish bin. I've never seen that before. So I say up to the child, what's why? And the six-year-old child says, because my mother says, it's not kosher. And that's why I'm not going to eat it. And the six-year-old man said to Rabbi Amnon Yitzchok, if a six-year-old child can have that self-restraint, then maybe a 60-year-old man can learn to have self-restraint as well. On Purim, we indulge in certain foods to remind ourselves of the fact that our greatest leaders have self-control. The Mitzvah Hashem should be a Purim full of joy and happiness. La Yehudim HaYisra'or, V'Simcha V'Sosav Yikar, Kein Tielon.